The history of Rocky Horror is a history of cinema.
For everything you like about Rocky Horror, there was at least one film that inspired it.
And we're going to review them all on Episode Zero.
Everybody, and welcome back to Episode Zero, the Rocky Horror Picture Show podcast, where we don't really talk about the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Scream, Wilhelm, scream. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
It's supposed to be scream, scream for your lives. My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic. I don't have a cute nickname. You don't have to call me anything if you don't want to.
You can call him Whitney.
You can call me Whitney. Or hey you, I'll take that.
Yeah. And every episode of the Episode Zero podcast, we look at the prehistory of a pop culture phenomenon to see how some of those popular movies ever made are really the byproduct of the movies that preceded and inspired them. We already did Star Wars. We're about two-thirds of the way through our look back at the Rocky Horror Picture Show. We're starting to wind down a little bit, but there's something that we hadn't really discussed in great detail that is very particular to the Rocky Horror Picture Show, and that is that the Rocky Horror Picture Show isn't just a movie. The Rocky Horror Picture Show, the classic cult musical that everybody knows and loves, it's also an interactive experience.
And who knew better? Who really pioneered a certain degree of audience interactivity than one of the master of film gimmickry himself, William Castle?
Yeah.
William Castle is one of the best filmmakers.
That is a bold statement that Whitney Seibel believes in. And let me tell you something. I am a late addition. I have only recently discovered William Castle, relatively speaking. Within the last few years have I actually started really delving into the filmography of William Castle. He is considered a schlockmeister. He is considered a showman. To some, he would be considered a con man. And Whitney considers him one of the greatest filmmakers of all time. And the more I delve into the filmography of William Castle, the more I am convinced that Whitney is right.
Well, I am, and we'll talk about that. Specifically, how it relates to his film, Mr. Sardonicus.
I have searched for a unique way whereby a motion picture audience can actually decide the climax of a picture. I have found such a way. My latest picture, Mr. Sardonicus, offers something no audience has ever had before: the power to determine the fate of a character on the screen, the power to punish. In ancient Rome, spectators could decree life or death to a gladiator by indicating thumbs up or thumbs down. During the French Revolution, the mobs could condemn a man by merely shouting, "To the guillotine." In the early West, vigilantes took the law into their own hands. Today, for the first time, the awful power to punish will be yours. After you see the evil events that made Mr. Sardonicus what he was, you will decide what should be done to him.
You know, Sardonicus is creepy, but he really illustrates the great array of sadists all over Hollywood slates.
Mr. Sardonicus. Well, it's impossible to talk about this era of William Castle's directing career, because William Castle was actually just a director for hire for many, many years. And he had made like 40 movies. He made like a bunch of Westerns and genre pictures just on the cheap.
So what you're saying, it is possible to talk about his career.
It's impossible to talk about this point in his career without addressing sort of the master that he had become at that point. Yeah. He made about 40 movies. And then in the late 50s and early 60s, he churned out this really great slate of horror movies that many of them famously had some sort of gimmick attached to them. William Castle is often compared to Alfred Hitchcock in his open love for the macabre.
Yep.
And also his insistence on inserting himself and his own personality into his work.
It's very, very common for William Castle to not just make a cameo in his movies, although that'll happen too, but to just flat out just walk up to the screen and say, "Hi, I'm William Castle. Welcome to my movie. In this movie, you might see ghosts, so get your goggles out." Like that kind of just absolute unapologetic, just he's your host. He wanted to not only tell fun horror movies, and a lot of his movies are genuinely really good, but he also wanted to be a showman. He wanted to be a ringleader in a cinematic circus. And, you know, Hitchcock and William Castle were actually, they were contemporaries at this point in their career, and they were doing similar stuff. Like, Hitchcock had his own Alfred Hitchcock Presents, in which he had effectively branded himself. He doesn't just make movies. Not a lot of filmmakers were household names. Not a lot of filmmakers still are, to most households. But a lot of people don't follow movies the way that the rest of us do. But Hitchcock was, because he had not only branded the type of stories that he told, but he connected himself and indeed his silhouette to them. So William Castle was doing the same thing. William Castle was also telling like big gimmick movies and trying to like grab people in the theaters with things that they had never seen before, at the very least promises thereof. And Alfred Hitchcock started following suit with films like Psycho, which broke all the rules, or The Birds, which also broke all the rules.
Well, Psycho was an interesting case, in fact, because and Psycho is usually the one credited for doing this, but people would not be admitted into the film after a certain amount had elapsed. Like, once the film has started, you won't be admitted. And this came from a time when people had just sort of, showtimes were posted, and people could come and go into movie theaters whenever.
Yeah.
There were two features, there were cartoons, there were newsreels, and they would just repeat it all on a loop.
There was no expectation that you would be there at the beginning of the program. You could come in anytime.
And we still use the phrase, "this is where we came in," to this day, to describe, you know, you come into a movie and you come in halfway. And then you wait around for the replay, and then you watch the first part again. It wasn't so sacred an experience at one point. And but that gimmick that you will not be... This is such a shocking film. All of the information is vital. You need to watch this one in order, is a William Castle gag that Hitchcock is clearly ripping off.
Yeah.
Now, William Castle didn't do subtle things about the information that's going to be handed to you in the film. He did things like plastic skeletons, and he had people posing as nurses signing, you know, checking on people who might be scared to death during the film.
They will check your blood pressure during the movie just to make sure you're not too scared of what William Castle is doing this week.
And there were two gimmicks in The Tingler, which is one of the best films of all time, where there was an... evidently, they had a plant, like an actor in the theater, who would scream and freak out, and an actor playing a nurse would come in and escort them out. Like, it was just too much for them. Like, the lights would come up, and they'd actually have to stop the movie so they could put on this little mini show. And then, of course, there was also Percepto, which was the vibrating seat cushions.
Percepto is maybe... I've never... Every once in a while, they'll do a screening in Los Angeles, or they have in the past, of The Tingler, and they'll actually install Percepto into the theater. The idea of The Tingler... And by the way, The Tingler, arguably William Castle's best movie. You should totally see it. We had to pick one for this particular film, and we thought Sardonicus had the most overlap with Rocky Horror. But in any case... The Tingler is a must-see. The idea of The Tingler is that Vincent Price has discovered that there is an invisible parasite living on your spine. And if it attacks you, it feeds off your fear,
it's
right?
When you get scared, like whatever like chemicals your body is producing causes it to get incredibly large.
Yeah.
And it's this strong little centipede-like monster that just sort of grows on your spine.
And the only way to prevent it from killing you when you get too scared is to scream. and screaming releases, I don't know, endorphins or something, and it just placates the monster.
It releases the fear. And that's an amazing movie because it also deals, there's like this meta-narrative about like part of it takes place in a movie theater. So we get the monster within the movie theater you're actually in, and also this commentary on old world silence. And anyway,
but the gimmick, as I was trying to explain, is there's a point in the movie in which they're at a movie theater, as Whitney explained, and the creature, the Tingler, escapes. And at that point, there's an announcement from the speakers. The movie goes dark, and you are told in no uncertain terms directly, you, the audience, the Tingler is loose in the theater, scream for your lives. And at that point, random seats in the movie theater had been outfitted with buzzers that would buzz your spine. So all of a sudden you'd feel the Tingler and you go,
little electric buzzers would vibrate in random seats throughout the theater.
Which is probably the most genius I think William Castle ever got with his gimmicks. He also did things like throw skeletons at the audience, and you would have like the Coward's Corner where you could like duck out of a movie.
If you're too scared, you had to go sit in the Coward's Corner.
Yeah.
And not all the gimmicks were great. In one of them, they outfitted some of the theater seats with seatbelts. Because it's going to be a real wild ride. You just buckle your seatbelt. Nothing else happens.
Yeah, there's no interaction there. It's not fun. But when it came to Mr. Sardonicus, William Castle did something that was and we'll explain, it's a total lie. It's just a lie.
It was 100% a con.
But the idea is neat, and the implementation is neat, and the movie around it is good. So the idea of Mr. Sardonicus, we'll walk you through the plot in a minute, but it's a horror movie about a mad sadist who kidnaps a doctor and forces him to cure this horrible rictus face that he's got. And at the end of the movie, Sardonicus has done such horrible things. There's a moment where the movie stops, and William Castle is back.
Appears on screen.
Yep, he was there for the intro, talked to you about how cool this movie is you're about to watch. And then he shows up and says, "Hey, you've seen the movie. That's Sardonicus, right? What a dick. Anyway..." I gave you, when you entered the theater, we gave you a punishment poll. And the idea is it's like a gladiator arena.
It's got a thumb on it. You can turn it thumbs up or thumbs down.
And the idea is this. When I say hold up your punishment polls, you're going to hold up your punishment poll and it's going to say thumbs up or thumbs down. And you're going to decide whether we're going to let Sardonicus go because you understood and empathized with him, or if you're going to give him his just desserts. And there's this adorable bit where William Castle says, "Okay, hold up your cards." And then he's like, "Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4. You in the fourth row, could you sit down? I can't see the people behind you. Thank you very much. Okay, and the couple on the left, is that one vote or two? It's two votes. Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, punishment it is." And the gag is he would tell the projectionist, run the evil ending, basically. And then the projectionist would do so. That's not how projectionists work.
No.
That's too late at that point.
The movie's already on a reel. You're not going to take it off and run.
And there's only like 2 minutes left in the movie, so they're not going to like add another reel to it like right at the last second. So
if I were projecting that, I would turn the projector off to make people think I was like loading up a new reel.
See, that would be clever.
Yeah.
That would be clever.
And maybe that was an instruction maybe to the projectionist to make it look a little more genuine.
It's not in the version of the movie I watched, but in any case, and then there's an evil ending, and we'll talk about the ending of the movie in a minute. Yeah, but
there's no kind ending.
Yeah.
It was never shot.
Nope.
It was never made.
A lot of people who wanted to believe in the gimmick thought, oh, maybe there was a kind ending and the gimmick didn't work, so they just went with the evil one and just hoped no one would care. It's like, no. Near as we can tell, that was never photographed. They never bothered. There was no intention of letting Sardonicus off the hook.
I don't think William Castle even wrote an ending.
You look at it and the ending doesn't even... And we'll talk about why, but having a nice ending doesn't even make sense based on the ending that we got. Like, the movie's over at that point. If there's a nice ending, the movie's done. So it doesn't make any sense at all.
But William Castle does encourage the audience to give the cruel ending, to punish him.
Yeah, why
to punish Sardonica. It's like, well, if you're one of those sensitive types who's like a forgive and forget, I suppose you could let him go off the hook. Or if you want to get revenge, like a fun person would. Like, he is encouraging the audience to be actively morally degraded in that moment. And that's the really interesting thing about the punishment poll and about Sardonicus in particular.
Yeah.
We are, in the same way Michael Haneke did in Funny Games, we are being implicated in the violence.
Yeah.
And I feel like William Castle, more than any other filmmaker, understood that presentation and interaction with an audience, the experience of seeing it in a theater with people around you, is maybe the most vital element of cinema.
Well, I think here's what William Castle did so beautifully, that there are a lot of brilliant movies that came out before William Castle, and arguably many, many, many that are better than his actual movies. I happen to think he's a legitimately good filmmaker. Mm. Blunt, but legitimately good. A film is typically seen as a passive medium. You sit in your couch or in your chair or in your bed, wherever you watch movies, and then the movie happens to you.
Yeah.
And then you watch it and maybe you lose yourself in it. That's kind of the idea, is that you're just supposed to watch the movie and let the filmmakers do what they do, and then when it's done, you form your own ideas. In my experience, that's not actually how it works. Your mileage might vary on this. I know we all process information differently and read stories differently, but when I'm watching a movie, I'm engaged with it, and I'm thinking about it, and maybe I'm trying to solve a mystery, or maybe I'm wondering how they did that, or maybe I'm asking myself moral questions about what is going on, or, oh, I hope it gets better than this, even. Is it something where I'm actively engaged in it? I think that William Castle wanted to make that subconscious, or at the very least, that quiet, active part of the brain physical and literal. And I think that's incredibly exciting. And in the wake of stuff like William Castle, where we have had things like the Rocky Horror Picture Show, which turned into a live shadow cast and people talking back to the screen, we've had a lot of people attempt to play with this more and more and more. We've had a Mystery Science Theater 3000, which is about watching other people watch a movie. There's a couple of actual experiments with literal interactivity in that Sardonicus way. There's a movie written and directed by Bob Gale, the guy who wrote or co-wrote Back to the Future, Mr. Payback, an interactive movie.
I've seen part of that. It's awful.
I heard it's awful. So it's a guy, it stars Billy Warlock. Yeah, it's Billy Warlock from Baywatch and Society. Society's the good one.
hey, come on. Baywatch was the biggest thing in the world.
It was. He did fine. Luke, stay away from things.
Luke is being naughty.
But Mr. Payback was about a cyborg who got revenge on people for doing bad things. And the idea is throughout the movie,
there's little things like you parked in my spot.
And the idea is that throughout the movie, people in the audience would have a little like remote control with like three different buttons on it. And depending on what got the most votes, then they would show you that part of the movie. Now, at that point, I think they were working with digital. So I suspect that one was digital, right? It was 1995, but it was Laserdisc. It was on Laserdisc. That's what it was. Yeah. So the idea is you could have branching narratives like that. And then, of course, video games started doing that, too. And we have, like, a whole genre of video games now, which are essentially interactive movies. Like, Until Dawn is one of those. It actually stars, like Rami Malek.
Like, it's like... You said the branching narratives, like what button you push will change sort of like which story you get.
Yeah, or but whether this character dies or lives or...
I'm not sure. I haven't played any of those, but from what I understand, like there's not much of a gameplay element. It's just sort of like choosing what to say and what to do.
Oh, it depends.
Both like single button pushes.
It depends. Some movies, some games have more than others.
Yeah.
A lot of it's just kind of a quick time event kind of deal. The idea is to basically cinematic experience made somewhat more active.
The problem with doing that in cinema is that cinema isn't, it's recorded. It's technology based. What with like Netflix, stuff like Bandersnatch, the Black Mirror film. And Netflix has done this a lot actually in the kids section. We recently discovered the Captain Underpants interactive TV special.
Oh, that's
where you can actually make decisions like, oh, do they draw a picture of a toilet or do they draw a picture of pee? You know, that's, it's really that kind of crass humor because it's Captain Underpants. But yeah, the interactiveness is a pretty fun element.
Okay.
But yeah, film cinema, that is, for the most part, through the bulk of its history, has not been interactive because it is a kind of a static medium. It's recorded. Time has always been the most vital element of cinema.
Yeah, it takes place within a specific amount of time, and it has to fill that time. It has to be engaging throughout.
And you can't shorten or lengthen. It's not like theater where you can like change your performance to lengthen or shorten the play.
Yeah.
It's rigid. It's set in set on that film strip. So that William Castle was able to put in these interactive elements using the film technology of the early 1960s is pretty astonishing.
It's relatively ahead of its time, I would say. It's a really high concept idea. And, you know, it's interesting because he realized that he had a story that was a functionally a morality story.
Yeah.
In which the protagonist of the story has to decide for themselves just what kind of fate Mr. Sardonicus will receive. And I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if they shot the whole movie and then William Castle's like, it's missing something. I need a gimmick. And then they just shot this prologue and this punishment pole and just shoved it in there.
Mm-hmm.
It works either way. Tell people about the plot to Mr. Sardonicus, because we've been talking a lot about the gimmick, but I actually also think it's a good movie.
It is a good movie, and it's a little unusual for William Castle in that it's a period piece. It takes place in the 1880s. It starts in London, where we get to meet our main character. He's a doctor who's been working on new kinds of medicine that haven't been tried before. And in fact, he gets one of the very first hypodermic needles.
Ooh,
the
kind, what are those?
The one that, a kind of needle that punctures the skin. Oh, why would you puncture skin? Well, it's a hollow needle and you can inject medicine directly into people's bodies.
Yeah, don't let it go right through the stomach anymore.
And he pulls it out of a box and, like, it's not covered or anything. It's just this needle.
Well, they hadn't invented sanitation yet.
No. But yeah, so he has all of these groundbreaking ideas about the way medicine, where medicine should go, and he's good at working on people with paralysis.
Yeah.
He gets a call from his ex-lover, who is played by, the doctor's played by Ronald Lewis. He gets a call from Audrey Dalton saying, hey, come to Totoslava, what's it called?
hang on.
It's a fictional Eastern European country.
Yeah, hold on, it's, I can't find it anywhere. It's a fictional country.
Yeah.
It's a weird European country that is functionally Transylvania from the original Dracula.
It's called Gorslava.
Oh.
They go to Gorslava.
Okay, everyone, careful where you step. The Gorslava.
I like Totoslava better. He goes to Gorslava.
Where, of course, the townsfolk warn him about this local figure, a gladiator with a very dry wit, Mr. Sardonicus.
A gladiator?
Doesn't that sound kind of Roman to you? Sardonicus?
Sardonicus. He does admit later on that he took the name from a Latin text.
There you go.
But yeah, this mysterious Baron Sardonicus, his paramour's new husband.
That joke was so... That just completely landed with a thud, didn't it?
Like, yeah.
No one cared.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, I'm off tonight. I apologize. Gonna let Whitney take point on this podcast.
Also, I love this movie, so...
I like it too.
I don't mind at all. But yeah, and he has to use his brilliance to cure some problem Baron Sardonicus has.
Well, at first he thinks it's his ex-lover, Maud, who's in trouble.
Hmm.
And he's there to potentially protect her from some mysterious ailment that maybe only his medical genius can do. And then, then I'll be seen as so great and she'll love me forever. And then he gets there, and as soon as he gets there, he's greeted by this, like, weird Igor type with one eye.
Krull.
Yeah, his name is Krull. He's got, like, a glaive with him. It's very...
Thud. It's another one.
Yeah. My name is William Bibiani. I'm a critic. Everybody calls me Thud. But no sooner does he walk into Sardonicus's castle than he hears a woman screaming and he rushes into her room. And this poor woman just has leeches all over her face. Mm. And he's like, what are you doing? You put leeches on this woman's face, you monster. He starts pulling off the leeches, which is not what you're supposed to do with leeches. You're supposed to make it warm so the leeches will like drop off on their own. So they don't like just try to rip into your flesh and pull it off and scar. So he's an idiot. But he says, okay, I've taken the leeches off of this woman's face. Now, no more leeches. I'm going to go and not check back in.
But because we're seeing, like, this kind of horrifying image of this woman with leeches all over her face, and they got a jar of real leeches next to her to give it, you know, a little bit more authenticity.
Sure.
It sort of, this is before we meet Mr. Sardonicus, and there's several scenes before we even meet the character where a servant will come up to the doctor and say, "Are you going to stop the experiments now?" And he's getting, like, we're really freaked out by this guy. Like, clearly something really untoward is going on in this castle. It's like in Dracula.
Yeah. And don't go into that room in the hallway. Yeah, it's got a giant padlock on it. No one's ever been in that room.
There's a padlocked room upstairs, and you cannot go inside.
There's a mysterious person living in the room across the hallway, and when they're handed food through the door, and they hear weird, creepy slurping noises. There's a lot of buildup. And then when they finally goes downstairs to have a nice dinner with his ex-girlfriend and Mr. Sardonicus, Mr. Sardonicus shows up, and he's wearing a creepy, lifelike human mask.
Yep, that covers his whole face.
Yeah, and Mr. Sardonicus is played by Guy Rolfe, and the mask looks like Guy Rolfe.
Yeah, it was like cast on his face.
So, like, imagine you're watching a horror movie and it's all this build up and like, oh god, who is this horrible creepy guy? And then Gary Oldman walks in, but he's wearing a mask that looks like Gary Oldman. Weird. And he says, "Oh, you're probably wondering about the mask and the leeches and the screaming and the padlock and the weird creepy monster behind the door. I'll tell you later. First, let's have a nice dinner. Everyone be polite and British. Everyone be polite and British."
They're polite and British, but in a, well, sardonic sort of way. There's a lot of hatred and animosity, and the creepy Krull is, like, standing over there saying things like, "Whatever he tells me to do, I do." And the makeup on Krull's eye keeps coming off.
Yeah.
Like, it's not the greatest makeup job.
No, it's
they give him this
cheap
little appliance they put over his eye, and when he stretches his face out, you can, like, see underneath the appliance, and, like, he's got a normal eye. But yeah, atmosphere of weird dread is hanging over all of this. And then there's a scene which I'm not really sure what exactly is happening in this scene, but they call in a bunch of local townswomen.
Yeah, they don't really get
and
into
they don't
this.
They don't explain why they're here. It's just this creepy psychosexual element all of a sudden.
A bunch of young, attractive women from town, and they're clearly, you know, impoverished. They're not, like, you know, wealthy ladies. They come in and say, "Oh, what are we here for?" "Creepiness." "Oh, okay. Each get a piece of gold, and one of you will be selected by Mr. Sardonicus. You will never see this person again." "Okay."
What is it for? The hell if I know.
Yeah. And so, you know, the Sardonicus selects one of them, the other ladies leave, and as they leave, they hear a horrifying scream, and then we never see that actress again, and we never really get back to that.
Well, what I suspect is happening is Mr. Sardonicus is getting off on this idea of terrifying people.
Yeah.
And
he's a sadist.
He's a sadist, and like, he just wants to whip off his mask and terrify people what his face looks like now. And he eventually explains to the doctor that his face is now frozen. It's paralyzed into this really hideous grin.
Yeah.
Like, this artificial grin. Like, even his nose is stretched out, and his teeth are...
Yeah.
For some reason, his teeth are also different. But
whatever. I think it's to hide the fact that it's a mask.
He's,
but, like, basically...
He's got, this really scary face.
He looks a lot like...
looks like Conrad Veidt in The Man Who Laughs.
I was going to say Conrad Veidt. He also looks a bit like Jack Nicholson in Batman.
Which are both the Joker.
Exactly.
Yeah. But yeah, he's got, like, this mutated face. And then there's a flashback sequence where he explains how he got that way.
And it's a great Tales from the Crypt, you know, Edgar Allan Poe type story. Where he was a young man, and he was married, and his wife wanted all these fancy things. And his father, who was very naive and had bought lottery tickets his entire life, bought a lottery ticket for the family and then died. And so they buried him, and it was very, very sad. And then, like, a week later, someone comes in and says, "Hey, I heard you guys got that winning lottery ticket." And they're like, we did? Yeah, your dad bought it. Oh, snap. So they look around trying to find the lottery ticket, and then they realize they buried him with it. So they have to rob their father's grave.
Well, and they explain early on when the doctor uses the word ghoulish to describe something. And they say, oh, around here we actually believe in ghouls. People who dig up bodies and eat them. And he's like, well, I don't believe in that. Well, we do around here, so be careful. Don't use the word ghoulish.
Yeah, it's a major faux pas.
And we learn why. It's because he robbed his own father's grave. And
the shock of seeing his father's... And by the way, his father decomposed quick.
No, actually, like, I think like a month or so had passed.
Still quick. Yeah. Still quick. He's basically a skeleton at that point. He decomposed pretty quick. But in any case, like, he sees his father's, like, taut rigor mortis smile, and he goes, ah! And then when we finally see his face again after the shock, he has also contorted his face into that smile, and it's stuck that way.
But yeah, total Tales from the Crypt kind of twist. Yeah. Seeing his dead father's body after he had robbed the grave for a lotto ticket. They got the lotto ticket.
Yeah, he got the money. His wife died. We won't get into that, but...
So yeah.
And then he had to relearn how to talk. And,
without using his lips. So he's essentially like a ventriloquist speaking with his throat.
Yeah.
So he doesn't have to put his lips together. His face is just frozen that way, but he can still talk.
Yeah, he can't really eat like a normal person, hence the slurping noises behind the door. He's basically been given like super gruel every night. And he has brought the doctor here to try anything he can do. He seems to be on the cutting edge of science to heal his frozen face. The doctor's like... okay, and then Sardonicus is just like, and if you don't, I'll, like, I don't know, kill the woman you love.
Kill my wife, who I know you're in love with.
Or I'll paralyze her face, and I'll be really terrible. And he's like, well, I'm a doctor, you didn't have to do that. I am Sardonicus!
And so, okay, well, I have this poison that I've been experimenting with poisons, and this could relax the muscles in your face. Do it! Well, it'll kill you. Do it anyway!
Well,
Do it or I'll kill your wife!
Well, you're speeding through it, basically. Yeah. But yeah, so the whole idea is he's now being kept hostage. And if he doesn't find a way to cure Mr. Sardonicus, you know, the woman he loves will be tortured and killed. And he sends away for his various medical things. And at the beginning of the movie, when he was talking about, you know, modern science, he also talked about how poisons are poison, but they also have medicinal properties when used in the right amount and in the correct way, which isn't unilaterally true, but it is kind of true. So he had some poisons sent to him so he can do some experiments. And Sardonicus sees that the experiments are going well. And so he says, okay, now use them on me. And he's like, it could kill you. Do I look like I give a shit? Well, you look happy.
It's like from Hellraiser 4, or is it 3 or 4? Do I look like the kind of man who cares what God thinks?
Yeah. So his scheme is, I'm going to give you this injection, and then there's more to it than this. I'm going to lock you into that secret room. By the way, that secret room has his father's corpse in it. You know, just for memories. And so he's going to lock him in the room with the corpse, and then it's supposed to, like, shock his system into fixing his face. It works.
It works.
His face is on. He can't, like, move his jaw yet or anything. He hasn't moved it in years. But he looks like Guy Rolfe, the star of Puppet Master 3, 4, 5, and Retro Puppet Master.
He was too long.
He was, for many films.
William Hickey was too long in the first one.
That's true. And I forget who was in the
Greg
second.
Greg Sestero was too long in Retro Puppet Master. Greg Sestero from The Room.
Well, Retro Puppet Master, but was he like the other too long? Because
he was the young too. It was the flashback. Too long.
Got it. But in any case, and Sardonicus, honestly, didn't really think he had it in him. Man of his word. He immediately gets right in the letters saying, hey, I hereby annul my marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Well done to everyone involved. And I let the doctor go. Does he want any money? And the doctor's like, no, I'm good. And he's like, great. Ta-ta. Mm. Or he can't say anything, but that's the gist.
His face now seems to be paralyzed and, like, back to normal. His face is still paralyzed.
Yeah. And the idea is that we'll go back to normal after a while. You're going to have to get used to that. And then our hero and the Sardonicus's ex-wife flee. And they're just about to get on the train when Krull, the manservant, shows up and says, his face is still stuck like that.
Like, he can't open his jaw.
Yeah, he can't eat. He can't speak. He can't drink water. He's going to die unless you come back and do something. At which point, the doctor explains, well, I didn't do anything in the first place. I gave him a saline solution, and I tricked him into curing himself because he had a psychosomatic condition. And all you have to do is tell him that, and then he'll get over it eventually. And at that point, everyone's feeling pretty good about themselves, and then William Castle shows up and says, okay.
Is that a good ending for Mr. Sardonicus? Yes? No? No!
Well, you're the boss, audience. Roll the bad ending. Mm-hmm. And then Krull comes back and says, I missed them. There is no cure. And then he just starts eating happily while Sardonicus goes mad. And
because he can't eat anything, and he knows he's going to starve to death.
What would the good... I think the good ending is just... Krull leaves, and then that's it. He tells his master, that's it. Like,
Krull tells his end, and maybe it's like, he figures it out, and his face works again. He's like, I was kind of a dick. I give all my money to charity. And I'm gonna let, no, because he won it in Lotto. It's not like something he earned. It was just a chance.
I guess that would be the mega happy ending.
So yeah, it would be like a mega happy ending, where he sort of like gets his face back and starts living a life of quiet poverty.
I guess my point is, I saw as a perfectly adequate, you know, Sardonicus gets let off the hook too easily, but it would have been a perfectly adequate ending for just the doctor to explain, it's all psychosomatic, it's in his head, you can tell him that, and then Krull leaves and they get on the train.
I outsmarted this jerk.
Yeah, that would be a reasonably okay ending. I like the evil twist ending. I think that's perfectly fair for Sardonicus. He was an asshole. Yeah. Anyway, that's a great little Tales from the Crypt kind of movie right there. Just mean and sadistic and kind of larger than life. Great big giant performances. Really creepy atmosphere.
It has this wonderful, and this is a quality from a lot of the best of William Castle's movies, this kind of gallows quality to it.
Yeah.
We compared it to Tales from the Crypt, but that's not just the story. That is this sort of gleeful enjoyment of all of the most macabre elements.
Yeah. It's not just, like I feel like there's a lot of horror movies that are all about, like, how horrible it is that this happened. Like, a lot of A24 horror movies. Yeah. They're just taking the horror completely dead seriously and viewing them as a tragedy, and that can be highly effective. But there is something to be said for the storyteller and the inflection that they give the story. It's the difference between, you know, being at a campfire story and have someone tell you the scariest thing ever, and being at a campfire and then people like holding up a flashlight and says like, ha ha, I gotcha. And like, that's William Castle. Mm-hmm. He's having fun with you, and the contract that he has signed with you is you're going to have fun in return.
We like, as critics, especially you and I, who are big fans of horror movies, like to make the argument, and we've also heard it given other places, that horror movies are cathartic in some sort of way. They're a safe way to look within yourself and deal with real-life fears that you might have. Mm. Okay, that's true.
To an extent, yeah. It's not the only reason, but yeah.
But also, we like gory shit, and being scared is fun. And I think that's something that a lot of conversations about horror don't so readily acknowledge, because it should seem self-evident.
Yeah.
It's fun to be scared.
It's fun.
It's especially fun to be scared in a big crowd.
Yeah.
With a bunch of other people who are also getting scared.
I feel like there's almost a certain jealousy that we sometimes have over horror storytellers who get to have that impact, who get to make us shriek. Mm. I feel like, you know, we talk about like, oh, it's a cathartic way to deal with our fears. It's also just a safe place to indulge, as you described, where we can watch murder and mayhem and villainy. And then at the end of it, it's just like, ha ha, nobody knows. Mm. I enjoyed that a lot. Like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
That can be perfectly fine, too. But I think there's this weird empathy that we have. I'm speaking for myself, and I know some of the people who feel this way. I almost feel more empathy for horror filmmakers than I do with filmmakers for any other genre because they get a rise out of us.
Yeah.
They get it seems like they're enjoying themselves more sometimes. Mm. And that right there is something that I connect to on a personal level. When I was a kid, I was scared crapless by horror movies.
Oh yeah.
Like I would had nightmares, I slept with the lights on, like I genuinely was terrified of Chucky, Jason Voorhees, serial killers as a general concept. Like, I was just terrified of horror stuff. Mm. It wasn't until I think I saw, I'm trying to remember the exact thing. I think it was when I saw Evil Dead 2. Hmm. And I saw that the wires and like the holes in the costumes and everything like that. And I realized someone made this.
Yeah.
And they got me. And I respected it. And I liked them for it. And it made me want to learn more about filmmaking. Hmm. And that's where I'm at now. And as a result, I feel like horror is my favorite genre, not just because it's fun, not just because it can be terrifying, not just because it can be deep, not just because it can be funny or romantic or all these things. It's a very versatile genre. But because I feel a real connection to the filmmakers in a way I don't with most dramas or rom-coms, you know?
With a lot of horror movies, especially really low-budget ones, and definitely the films of William Castle, you can feel that the filmmakers are really interested in the stories they're telling you.
Yeah.
They're doing it because there's sort of a passion to it.
Like, they love it.
It's
look at the shit I came up with.
Yeah. Even when you get somebody who's really kind of workmanlike about it and is just sort of doing the job, somebody like John Carpenter,
He's a brilliant filmmaker, but he's very efficient.
Yeah, he has no romantic feelings about his films. Like, I've interviewed Don Carpenter before. Yeah. He's like, oh, yeah, I just put a camera down and I filmed it. It's like, well, what was the idea behind it? I had a script and I filmed it. What do you mean, the idea?
Yeah, this made sense to shoot it with this covered. Mm-hmm. He's got an innate talent for it. Mm-hmm. In some movies, he's thought out more than others, but... Yeah. Yeah, his efficiency is his genius.
I think, I'm not sure if he'd even call himself an artist. He's just a guy there running the camera.
Yeah.
And, you know, sitting behind the camera chain smoking. There's indeed a shot in Halloween where see smoke wisp past the camera, and that's John Carpenter's cigarette smoke, like in shot.
When I was like younger, more fanciful, and thought that John Carpenter might do such a thing, I wondered if that was an homage to the original The Blob. There's a scene in the original The Blob, which if you've never seen the original 1950s version of The Blob starring a young Steve McQueen, very good film, holds up very well. There's a bit where Steve McQueen is like talking to his date, and then it's clearly like at cigarette height. You just see smoke wafting in from the right side of the screen. It's clearly someone off camera. It's clearly a mistake. They clearly didn't think anyone would give a shit because it's a low budget horror movie.
John Carpenter wouldn't have thought to do something like that.
No, who would have? But I remember thinking to myself, oh, what a brilliant homage. John Carpenter, you can do no wrong, sir.
That's like, that sounds like something like Edgar Wright would do. Yeah. It's like he's taking notes and trying to recreate very specific things for like film trivia. Not.
Feels like sort of thing Mel Brooks would notice and turn into a gag.
Yeah. John Carpenter, even though he was sort of a workmanlike director, was still very fond of the kinds of things he was telling stories about. And he understood that horror was something that could be fun. And William Castle loved horror. He loved the scene. You can find photo shoots of him, like, eating severed heads at a dinner table. He made movies for weird little kids who love this horrific stuff.
Yeah.
Before there was even Famous Monsters of Filmland, he's making it for this subcategory of horror nuts.
It feels interesting to me that, like, I feel like... At least within some communities, like I know a lot of people at like the Schmodown who think that the horror genre doesn't deserve its own division. But we have like inner geekdom in Star Wars. And I'm like, before we had comic book movies that were that successful, before we had Star Wars, you know what was keeping geekdom alive as a concept in movies? Horror. From the Universal movies on down, like horror kids were like reading the magazines, playing with the toys, talking about who would beat who in a fight. Yeah, like I think it's a key part of like the history of the medium.
Yeah, what we refer to as sort of like modern geekdom, that is to say, a certain type of obsessive fandom. Separate from people who just enjoy watching a movie.
Yeah, but people who will pay
closer attention, take notes, and catalog information. Yeah,
or
even go so far as to collect things.
Yeah.
That's fandom. It's separate. And a brief history of that, Hugo Gernsback, that the Hugo Awards are named after, started having letters columns in his weird science fiction pulp magazines. People started interacting. Modern fandom is born.
Yeah.
And... that world was always like kind of there lurking around. Because when Hugo Gernsback started opening up those letters columns,
people were already there.
People were there. They started interacting and they loved interacting. They loved having these really deep, completely meaningless debates about, you know, science fiction stories that they had read in the previous issue. And, you know, years later, Forrest J. Ackerman would come along and start Famous Monsters of Filmland, which was the same thing for horror movies. And he was one of Hollywood's most notorious memorabilia collectors. I think the Acker Mansion, I think it was spread out. I think people snatched up the things in Forrest J. Ackerman's collection and they kind of redistributed them. I'd have to look that up.
Yeah.
When he passed away, like they tried to keep the Acker Mansion together, but I think they split it up.
I don't know.
It'd be really sad though, because it was a great collection. But there were some filmmakers who were savvy enough to understand that there were fans already, people into this weird stuff, and people who were enjoying the fact that they were weird. And William Castle spoke directly to them. You like the macabre? Boy, howdy, is this weird. He didn't go so far with like the gore.
There's violence. There's some of these movies are more violent than others. Like there's like a beheading in the movie Straitjacket. But even that's like in shadow. It's a bit more implied.
He wasn't like Herschel Gordon Lewis, who's just like dumping buckets of blood on people on camera.
No,
but he did understand that there's something really, really fun to a certain segment of the film going public, who are maybe around 10 years old, who just really love this idea of death and torture and fear and fright.
And what we're talking about really is a cult audience. Yeah. And that's something that connects directly with Rocky Horror Picture Show. Oh, we're going to make a movie that connects really, really strongly with a small demographic of people who get really fanatical about it. People who like the weird, the macabre, the sexual, the kinky, the comedic, the bizarre. People who like interacting with the movie. Yeah, that's a great demographic to have. And if you connect with them strongly enough, they will keep your movie alive forever.
Yeah.
And that's something Rocky Horror has done very successfully.
I feel like we don't get too much of that in the modern world because not only are studios hyper-vigilant about what's going to sell to the widest possible audience, the PG-13 rating is now just the only rating we have anymore, it seems. But I feel like so many filmmakers are being raised in that milieu, take a drink, that there's not so many weird filmmakers really pushing in from the boundaries. You have to really search for them now.
They might not be reaching the same audience, and it might take longer for their work to find a giant audience, but they're out there. There are people who are still making those weird horror movies.
Something like The Lighthouse or The Witch.
The Eggers films.
Yeah, the stuff from A24. Occasionally,
Midsommar, I think, is already building that kind of notoriety. Yeah.
Occasionally, you'll find something like a kooky animated film. Like, I think Paranorman is very much in line with the William Castle ethos.
I feel like it's a question of what size we're talking about here. And are they sizable enough to keep screenings of the movie alive every single week? No. But there's a certain class of people where if you bring up the movie The Guest with Dan Stevens, people, their eyes light up because they know that that movie is fucking amazing. And full disclosure, I am on a Schmodown team with one of the stars of that movie, Brendan Meyer. But in my defense, I was singing that movie's praises long before I ever met that guy. The Guest is that kind of weird, wonderful film that like connects with a small group of people. It's not really mainstream, but connects with a small group of people really, really strongly. And that's something that William Castle managed to not just do once. Like a lot of filmmakers can do that like once or twice. He managed that throughout his entire like long-standing career and made a wide variety of popular and sometimes less popular, but no less great, bizarre horror movies. And before we move on, because we could dedicate a lot of episodes to William Castle because we love William Castle so much. Are there any other William Castle movies you want people to go out of their way to see if they haven't already? We already mentioned The Tingler.
We mentioned The Tingler. Yeah. The Tingler is, one of the best ones. House on Haunted Hill is really terrific.
Not my favorite, but I know a lot of people love it.
I love House on Haunted Hill. I love The Tingler. I mean, these are all good. Straitjacket is the one with... it was argued that he made a couple movies with Joan Crawford, and it was argued that Joan Crawford was the gimmick, like getting Joan Crawford to star in these sort of like schlocky horror movies. But she was in Straitjacket, and she was in I Saw What You Did.
Straitjacket was written by Robert Bloch, who wrote the novel Psycho is based on, and it's another sort of mind-bending, is this person know they're a killer or not movie. Yeah. It's really genuinely good. Not like, oh, how eccentric and fun. Like, no, like a genuinely good horror movie. And I think Joan Crawford gives a legitimately great performance in that movie. Yeah. I think she's wonderful in that. I recently found a film, thanks to my wife and partner, M. Lapis da Silva, who's a big fan of it, called Let's Kill Uncle. Yeah. Have you seen that one?
It's been a while. I've seen most of these, but yeah, like I marathoned through them like in my early 20s. Yeah.
Let's Kill Uncle is a great movie. It's like you talk about how like there are horror movies for kids. Mm. That's exactly what Let's Kill Uncle is. It's about a little kid whose rich father dies. His father's played by William Castle in one shot. And then he is going to an island to be raised by his famous soldier father, or sorry, uncle, who was an assassin in World War II and has written lengthily about various murder techniques. And when he gets there, his uncle says, "Well, you inherited a lot of money. I didn't. And now I'm going to kill you. Good news for you. I have to make it look like an accident. So, you could last a while. Just stay on your toes." And then he ends up getting the idea to kill his uncle first. Which is just such a delight. Talk about ghoulish. What a greatly ghoulish storyline. I'm also a huge fan of the original 13 Ghosts.
Yeah, that's really fun, too.
That movie was great. That had a great gimmick where there were these kind of like 3D glasses, where the old school ones where you had a red pane and a blue pane. And depending on which pane you looked through, you would either not see any ghosts because you were too scared to look at the ghosts, or you would see the ghosts more clearly because the ghosts were, I think, blue, and then if you wore red, they would be highlighted, or vice versa.
The screen turned red, and the ghosts were blue. And if you believe in ghosts, you look through the red, and you can see the ghosts. And if you don't believe in ghosts, you look through the blue, and you just see a scene with... You still hear the ghosts.
No, it's to get the gist of it.
And the design of the ghosts is really cool. They even incorporated the gimmick into that not very good remake of 13 Ghosts.
Oh, yeah, where they have goggles to see the ghosts.
You can't see the ghosts unless you're wearing these special goggles.
I like that remake.
Within the movie.
I think that remake is fun. It's not amazing. But the original is actually like a really great slumber party horror movie. Like, it's got a really good tongue-in-cheek quality to it without like completely undercutting the scares. There's a great... there's a really, 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 really great cameo from, Margaret Hamilton from Wizard of Oz, where she plays like the landlady or the maid, and everyone talks about how she's a witch. She was the Wicked Witch of the West in the Wizard of Oz.
Isn't that cute?
Yeah, but it actually goes somewhere, and it's really fun. That movie's great. I hope people see it. William Castle is one of the great filmmakers people don't talk about enough. And it's been really, really exciting to highlight their work.
Yeah.
Next time on episode zero, we are going to be looking at the work of a certain Williams. Which kind of Williams?
What?
The Tennessee Williams.
Oh, God.
Based on Tennessee Williams, sorry.
That's the weirdest introduction to Tennessee Williams I think I've ever heard.
I have to make it interesting.
We talked about William Castle. Now we'll be talking about Williams, Tennessee. It's a weird link.
We're talking about Ilya Kazan's controversial 1956 black comedy, Baby Doll, starring Carol Baker, Carl Malden, and Eli Wallach. We're going to talk about how this film navigated controversy and how it dealt with issues which Hollywood wasn't comfortable talking about. And I've actually never seen this one, so I'm actually really excited about this. So we will be talking about Baby Doll next time on episode zero. The podcast where we don't really talk about Rocky Horror.
Yes, indeed.
Even though it's all about Rocky Horror. Thank you, everybody, for listening. You can, by all means, if you're so inclined. We would love to hear from you if you want to talk about William Castle or anything else we discussed in this episode or anything else you want to talk about. You can email us, letters@criticallyacclaimed.net is the email address. We're also on Twitter, @criticacclaim. I am @WilliamBibiani.
I am @WhitneySeibold.
We have a Patreon. That's patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. And at our Patreon, we have a lot of exclusive shows, including shows about Star Trek, the Academy Awards, Disney, Batman. We're doing commentary tracks. We're going to record a commentary track for Batman and Robin in the next week or two. And, of course, you can also vote for future episodes of our various shows on that Patreon. So, very special shout-out to every single one of our patrons, without whom our shows would not exist. Like, none of them, even the free ones. So, thank you to everybody who helps keep this show alive. If you can afford to join in, we sure would appreciate it. And if you can't, we totally get it. Leave us a review wherever you find us. That would really, really help us out a lot. Whatever star rating you think is fair, write a couple sentences. That really helps the show more than you might think. And of course, if you like soap, and I hope you do because it keeps us clean, we have an Etsy store, M. Lapis de Silva and I, called Salt Cat Soap. All one word, Salt Cat Soap. Look for the picture of Luca biting soap. He doesn't do it in real life because it's soap. But in sketch form, as drawn by M. Lapis de Silva, it's very cute. And we have a lot of hand-designed, fancy soaps. Get them for yourselves. Get them for Mother's Day or Father's Day. They're really nice, and I'm really, really super proud of how they turned out. I've designed a few, but M. Lapis de Silva's are really wonderful, and I hope you check them out because they're great. Anyway, that's it for the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
It's called Episode Zero.
And until next time, I see you with anticipation.